Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, this is Carl, and you're listening to another episode of 50 Fires. Today, my guest is somebody that feels like an old friend because we've done this before and we've been running in similar circles, you know, people who talk about money on the internet. We've been running in similar circles for over a decade. Farnoosh Torabi is, I'm not exactly how to describe her. She's all things with money. Her podcast, So Money, has been around forever, since 2015. I believe I was episode 253, give or take an episode or two. So she's been having candid conversations about money for a really long time. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with Farnoosh. We talked about her relationship to money growing up and how that has shaped not only her life, but her career and the work that she does. It felt really important to me to learn from Farnoosh about the role that gender continues to play in the conversations that we have about money. So with that, enjoy this candid conversation about money and meaning with Farnoosh Torabi. I'm so excited about this.
Oh, the feeling's mutual. Thank you so much. Congrats on your podcast too. So happy you're doing it.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know that I've ever heard, like, what's your earliest memory of money?
I'm at the department store at the counter of Jordan Marsh, which is now, rest in peace. I think now it's like Macy's in Worcester, Massachusetts, where I was born. And my mother, my eyesight is like right at the edge of the counter, of this glass counter. My mother has her wallet out and she's paying this woman at the store, and we haven't bought anything. So I asked her, I remember, like, what is this about? Like, what are you buying? Because I don't see what this is producing. And she explained to me, and I think I was like 4 years old, she explained to me that she had purchased some items in the past and she's here to pay for them. And I said, oh. And I mean, basically explaining to me, I'm paying my credit card bill.
Yeah, which in those days was called what? Like, what do we call that?
Layaway.
Right,
basically. Right. But I think it was actually on a credit card, and she was paying the bill in the store rather than like putting it in the mail. She was coming into the store to reconcile that bill. But the layaway also was something that I witnessed at TJ Maxx. as one did in the 80s, would go to TJ Maxx and put stuff on layaway. But yeah, my first memory is being with my mom and watching her shop and make these purchasing decisions. And shortly after that, it was the memory of my parents arguing about money.
Tell me about that, because I know I've read and heard you say many times that money wasn't taboo in the family.
It wasn't taboo.
But tell me about the arguing part.
We spoke fluent finance in our household, but it's not to say that it was always poetic. You know, it was often, yeah. I say, the sound of money, of the fear of money, is fists pounding on a laminate kitchen table. Growing up, there were many hard conversations my parents had around money, fights. Basically, it came down to power. My father made the money. My mother didn't. My mother wanted to buy stuff. They had different ideas of what a happy life would look like and feel like and how they would afford it. And so that became a huge power struggle. And I think layered on top of that too was it was gendered for them. You know, my dad felt like as the provider and the sole income provider that it was his domain, money was his domain, don't ask me questions. Because then it was suggesting that we didn't trust him or he wasn't doing something right. So it was a lot of that, but I witnessed it. I was an only child until about 11 years old. And so it was for a while, just the three of us. And I was just, and we lived in a small house. So I was able to, for better or worse, be witness to that. I think it was, I mean, in hindsight, it worked out because I think that's where I became extremely aware of just how important money is, especially as a woman, to have that financial autonomy and agency growing up.
Can you recall what that felt like? Like, what was the feeling of that as a child? Like, the when you use the pound fist on the laminate table, metaphor or reality?
No, that was real.
Okay, go back to that. Like, what did that feel like?
Oh, it was gutting. I remember they would be arguing in the kitchen, and I would just be, you know, 15 feet away in the on the couch, curled up, trying to pretend like I was watching TV, but really I had one ear to the TV and one ear to them. And I think too, because in the midst of the chaos, I became a people pleaser. I became the child in the family that always wanted to make things okay. So inevitably, if they were in a fight, I would like start fixing up the room. I would take out the trash. I would go make my bed.
Wow.
I would try to find order in the disorder. And as an adult, cleaning for me, it's like not just because I like a clean house. I think for me, it's very emotional to be able to clean because it brings a sense of control to me. Where as a kid, I felt like there was a lot of chaos around me. A lot of it stemming from financial issues. It's a deep thing.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so interesting to me how, I don't know, universal is not the word I'm looking for, but just how the story, well, at least the idea that everybody has seems to have a story like that, mm-hmm. that feels universal.
You know,
it's they're all different. They're all obviously unique, but the idea of like an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old trying to make sense of what's happening, sometimes it was out in the open. Oftentimes it's hidden,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the idea that there was some force, you know, some power, something called money that was causing energy crisis, you know, like conflicts, energy.
Yeah. And I think, Carl, it made me grow up a lot faster than I would have normally. You know, I have friends who their reflection of money as a kid, is like, I don't have one, you know, my parents never talked about it. I sort of lived in this like fairy tale life. Where things would just appear, and I had things, and my parents were, you know, I did not go without, you know, I feel like they did their best, and I never felt quote unquote poor or anything like that. I think it was just that what I learned very quickly was that money can be contentious, that in a relationship. Especially for women, money is very important to have your own money, and that money is power. My mother went eventually to get fully educated and get a job. And I saw that as well. And I think that her fear of losing her financial independence fueled her to get out there and do something about it rather than just be reacting to it all the time, to be proactive. And that's what I read about in my book, A Healthy State of Panic, how fear, this feeling that I had constantly as a kid growing up, which I inherited from my immigrant parents, was in some ways very helpful because it motivated us to go out and do things that would, you know, calm the fear and make us feel more at peace and more assured and confident.
What tools have you found useful in recognizing those old beliefs or old habits that are no longer serving you?
Well, the one shortcut I like to use is, so sticking with fear. So if I'm afraid of losing my money and I am playing into that fear in an unhealthy way, which means that I'm just sort of like allowing it to make me feel stuck, to not inspire me to think at all creatively. What I find is like, what's helpful is to take the fear to the dark side. Like actually think about a couple scenarios that could be pretty terrifying. Like one, in this fearful state, led by this fear, you refuse to look at your finances. You have this sort of paralysis around money. And so what's your future like? Like in 5 years or in retirement, because you have been neglectful, you've allowed this fear to keep you neglectful. My guess is that in the future, you're going to have a much harder life. And then the other exercise you could do is like actually go to the dark side. Like actually think about, if I did lose all my money tomorrow, if I lost my job, if my house burned down, I don't have insurance, you know, all these things, like, what am I left with? So the, in some ways, like thinking about the hard stuff, thinking about how hard and scary things could get with your money is a shortcut to figuring some things out, jotting down some ideas. Like if you actually think you're going to lose your job tomorrow, let's pretend that happens. What are the first five things you're going to do? You're going to write that down. You're going to look up your unemployment insurance. You're going to look into your savings. You might want to go in tomorrow at work and find out what's been the average severance that they give. And then suddenly now you have a plan for that what if scenario. And what seemed to be a very abstract fear now becomes a very real concrete fear that you can actually work with and do something about. And hopefully that day never comes. Hopefully you keep that job or you leave on your own terms. But if not, at least you've done this work, which was fueled by fear, but the right way of dealing with the fear, making something abstract that's just like living in your head to something that is very real and immediate and personal.
No, I love that. It strikes me that you've had, so your podcast, 1,600 episodes, which is just crazy. Like, congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you think of any stories? Because I'm thinking of some of the guests you had on that, like, and by the way, the like diverse sort of range of perspectives, because we've all been living in one, largely one perspective. And then somebody else shows up and is like, boom, tell me some stories about that. What's the craziest thing or the most interesting that you're not even sure, like, I'm not sure that's true.
A couple of things quickly come to mind, but my husband actually, so I'll talk about guests, but my husband one time, a few years ago, before the pandemic, I was in a financial panic because I had started a passion project / side business with two other co-founders. We built a financial museum, a museum for dedicated to financial feminism in Los Angeles. Like, I think like Museum of Ice Cream, but make it money for women. And it's really fun. It was 11 different rooms. It was this experiential, like we turned a warehouse into this basically pop-up museum. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of financial turmoil behind the scenes, and things we couldn't have imagined happened. And so we ended up with some debt, the three of us, which we have now paid off. And thankfully that's behind us. But in that moment of trying to figure out how to get ahead of this and get my head out of above water, I started panicking and I like imagine, you know, like the worst case scenario. And I'm like, all right, I need to start making more money somehow. So I started creating more products and a workshop, and I started bringing in extra revenue. I started hustling a lot. And my husband is watching me like with all this stress. I was really stressed. I mean, to the point where my body was screaming at me. I had itchy scalp. I couldn't sleep at night, heart palpitations. I mean, really just, and this was not even, this was for months. This was from like January to May. I remember it was that whole Q1 and Q2. And he like stopped me at one point. And I make more in my marriage. I've written about it. I'm all about, you know, advocating for women breadwinners. So he says to me, listen, we'll be okay because it's just money. And on the one hand, I was like, how could you say that? It's like, Right. Yeah, it's not just money. It's money that we need to build, continue having the life that we have. And
yeah. And
look, I wasn't going to bankrupt us over this, but it was just the sort of thing where I didn't want to have to, you know, tap into the savings and maybe even like, I was considering like, oh my gosh, do I have to like take an early withdrawal out of my SEP IRA to make this to be liquid enough for, because I had cash flow issues at one point, but it all worked out. But he said, it's just money. And I think he, from his perspective, right, a person who was not raised necessarily under the stress that I was around money, who had maybe in some ways, I don't want to say privilege or luxury, but he just didn't have that. He didn't have that dark side of money as a kid growing up. He had different issues, you know, divorced parents, single mom raising him, but he could see money as just a tool, whereas I was looking at it as everything. Yeah. And to him, it was like, look, it's just money. In other words, like, we're going to have our health. We're going to have our family. You have still your resilience. No one can strip you of that. No one can strip us of that. Those are the things. You know, money is important, but it's just one tool in your arsenal. And so you take that away, but you still got so much else. Like, look at everything you've built. I mean, basically, he was just putting a mirror up to my face when he said that, which sometimes we can forget and we don't recognize in the thick of all that turmoil and chaos, is like we just forget who we are and what our patterns have been and the vigilance that I was bringing to this. And when he said that, though, it allowed me to, I almost cried. I mean, because I think what I was worried a lot about was disappointing the family and him. Right. And for him to say that, it was almost, again, giving me permission to not get so wound up. Like, you're going to do the right thing, Farnoosh, because you always do. You'll figure it out. That's your solutions driven. Mm-hmm. But don't add to that stress this feeling of like, my husband's going to be disappointed in me, or my family will be disappointed in me because of this, you know, this risk that I took. And man, what a fast track MBA too, starting a business when you have never done it before like that. Learned so much.
I bet. Thanks for sharing that. It's so interesting in those moments that sometimes those moments feel like, what are you talking about? Like, you're rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, like that kind of, how can you be?
And you're the guy playing the violin, like nothing's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, wait, you're pointing at something. Oh, like, and that's happened multiple times to me where you're just like, oh, wait, you must be thinking something I'm not thinking, because what you just said has not. Oh, now I understand. Like, suddenly, like, that little door opening to like, oh, there's a different way of viewing this is so powerful. And being able to be curious about that, right? Like, be curious about the thing that somebody just said.
Yeah.
Tell me another story.
So a couple of takeaways from my podcast, there's two that stick out that I have started to practice. And one has been already incredibly helpful to me. There was a guest on the show and he said, you know, there's two ways to make money. You make money from what you do and you make money from what you know. And I, you know, I thought about that. I said, tell me more. He's like, okay, so maybe you're a fourth grade teacher or you're a chemistry professor, and part of, you know, you can make money as a professor. That's what you do. And you have so much knowledge. You have so much of you have life experience. You have other skills that you're not utilizing as maybe a college professor. Maybe you speak Spanish. Maybe you're really great catering. You could start a catering business, but that there's so much that we're not leveraging as humans to go out there and make more money. In addition to what we do, we can make money from what we know. And it could even be something like how you became the person you are, that journey. A lot of people people come up to you, like I'm sure people ask you, or I know I'll get that question a lot, like, how did you write a book? How did you build a business? How did you start a podcast? Well, in the beginning, I was just telling people, but then I realized, like, if enough people are asking, maybe there is a business here to make, as opposed to just, you know, doing the podcast. Maybe I can make money from how to, you know, start this, and my knowledge I can leverage. And so this was back in, like, after the financial recession, just when I just started the podcast. And I think that strategy essentially allowed me to like double my earnings, you know, and also to be more in control of my income, because making money from what I do, it usually depends on someone hiring me to be able to like perform that. Right. But to make money from what I know, I control that. I control how I do that, how I teach that, how I market that, what I price that. And so, you know, that was a financial game changer for me. And the other thing is Bill Perkins came on the show. He's the author of Die with Zero. I'm sure you've read it, where he's flipping the script on estate planning and leaving a financial legacy, where he's all about leaving a financial legacy while you're alive. So, you know, why are we so wrapped up in this practice of giving our estate or passing on our wealth to our loved ones after we've died? You know, if on the average, like maybe you pass away at 80 and your children are in their 60s or 50s, that's when you want to help them out financially, when they could have really benefited from your ability to, you know, paying off their student loan debt or helping them buy that first house or starting that business. I think more and more now we're starting to realize the importance of of doing that and why not? You know, there might, I think, I don't know, maybe the narrative behind that was just like, I work so hard. I don't want to give my kids an easy life. They, you know, they need to learn what it's like to make it out on their own first. But he put it in real practical terms for me. Like, you know, if you're inheriting all this money at 60, let's hope you're in good health, because, you know, if you want to be able to use this money to travel, or it's just, you know, I think nothing against leaving some money reserved for after you pass on, but to not be so restricted in that you don't consider also supporting those who you want to support during your living years, when you can also see that impact. And in the personal finance world, a lot of people won't talk about how they got help from their parents because they feel like it's a shameful thing. And I think we're getting beyond that. We're getting past that a little bit. Like, I've always talked about it. My very first book, I was like, my parents took the equity out of their home in Massachusetts, part of it, and helped me buy a studio in Manhattan. And then I went and I took out a line of credit against that studio, paid my parents back, and now then refinanced that home equity line of credit into a mortgage. So that's how we did it. But how else was I supposed to do it as a 23-year-old in New York City? And yeah, absolutely, tons of privilege. But these days, you're probably seeing more and more about how to leave a financial legacy for your kids. Starting to think about that now generationally is so important. And I think hopefully that we're getting past that shame of helping out your kids. I mean, because if you can, you do it. I would do it. Like, I would, nothing against you, you know?
Yeah.
It the cost of living, like the ability to buy a home as a first time home buyer right now, like the age has increased for first time home buyers, and it's the spread between what you make and the cost of a home now is like 6x versus it was like 4x for our parents' generation. And if you're in San Francisco, it's like 10x right now. So, I mean, it's not about just pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and working hard and then being able to buy a house. Sometimes you need an influx of cash from somewhere, somehow.
Yeah. We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to 50 Fires. This book, When She Makes More, so fascinating to me, and the conversation around it and what you've had to say about it. Let's start with like this providing thing. And I think I heard you say in answer to a question on one of the talk shows you were on when you were engaging with somebody, I think the statement, I think it was you, I don't think it was the guest, I think it was you that said men are often defined by their income.
Yes, it was on Tamron Hall.
Yeah.
And she brought up the point where she said this famous actor, whoever, she gave an example of like, I interviewed this one guy and he's a celebrity, and he said that if he was making $35,000 a year and his wife was making $35 million a year, I'm getting the numbers mixed up, but let's say he was making less than his wife, he would insist upon living on his income.
The house specifically, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'd buy a house that based on my
right income. We buy a house. We our lifestyle is not about your $35 million. And I'm like, what is that about? You know?
Yeah. Like, what is that about?
It's primitive. It goes back. I mean, you brought up Brad Klontz. I interviewed him. He and I did a study actually for When She Makes More. He was really helpful in helping me write that so that I could understand the behavior behind all of this and where it stems from. And he's like, look, centuries and centuries of conditioning where we have exclusively made it so, you know, man, you are the provider of the income. You go out and work and come home, and then the woman is in the home working, making nothing. And that is how we will praise you in society. That's how we will recognize you as worthy fathers, as worthy husbands, as worthy citizens in this country. And so that being told to you and modeled for you over and over and over again, it's a hard thing to break away from. And so even when you find modern couples where if you survey them, they say, we both believe in feminism. We both believe in equality. We both believe in all of the things. Everyone's born, raised equal. Money doesn't matter. And yet they will probably find themselves in a sticky situation where if they're the man and they're making less than their female partner, there is going to be some tension or awkwardness and they won't even know how to communicate around it because that hasn't been modeled. And it feels like it is your virtue as a man to go out there and provide financially. And likewise for women, and you're seeing this now too online, TikTok, it's the cesspool of TikTok where all these, it's like hashtag stay at home girlfriend, hashtag trad wife, traditional wife, and these women glamorizing this leisurely sort of kept woman, kept wife lifestyle where it's all about serving to their husbands, allowing him to shine as the financial provider and saying, this is the model, y'all. Like, this is it. This is how you achieve fulfillment and happiness. It's like, what? We're going back in time. It's the dark ages, but we are resistant as a species to this idea of a world where women can make more than men and everyone can live harmoniously.
Yeah.
So I wrote this book, When She Makes More. It came out in 2014. It's the 10th anniversary. And I thought by now we wouldn't be talking about it or it would be irrelevant or we would have all figured it out. And I feel like if anything, times now are scarier or more threatening to this notion of women becoming financially independent and God forbid making more than their husbands. And I will say too that it's not just the men who are uncomfortable with it, it's the women too sometimes where they don't, because again, where there is fear or discomfort, there is usually a lack of literacy and there is a lack of experience and there's a lack of seeing it modeled for you. Like, we don't like the unknown. We don't like uncertainty. Like, we know what it's like to perform our duties. Women, we know what it is like to perform our duties as dutiful housewives because we've seen that modeled. Yeah. We know the playbook. Men know the playbook for how to be the financial breadwinners. So when the playbook gets reversed, we all have to learn new ways of cohabitating and communicating. It's not that simple. It's not that simple. It's just, okay, well, just let's just swap the incomes because as we've discussed already, money is emotional and we have stories tied to that money. And for me, when I was dating my now husband, and it was clear from the get-go that as an entrepreneur and he is a software developer, like, you know, we started out kind of evenly financially and then I kept making more and making more. And it wasn't a problem necessarily for us, I think because we had already been used to it from the beginning of our relationship. But it was very difficult for my mother, who even though she knew how important it is for a woman to have her own financial freedom, fists pounding on laminate tables, remember. She worried that as a woman who made more in the relationship and as a woman whose income was so much tied to the livelihood of that household, when kids enter the picture, what's going to happen then? Because her assumption was that I would want to stop working or I would feel stuck not knowing how to choose between work and being with my kids. Because from my mother's generation, you can't have it all. You can't do both. You can't do both well. And so her fear for me was that, well, maybe this is all nice. Your kids aren't in the picture. You make more. It doesn't matter. But when you do have children, she was worried that the economics would become very limiting for us. And the way that we were bringing in the money would be limiting for us, and it would be at the detriment of our children, which has not been the case. But it's just because, again, she didn't have anything else modeled for her. And so she, for her, this was completely foreign. And that element of it was what was fueling the fear. But I think over the years, as I have now modeled for her how it can be done differently, and, you know, not perfect, but, you know, it's fine. It's all good, fine. Mom. It's good. You know, no drama.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now our daughters, our oldest is in private equity, distressed private equity in New York. Our second just got into med school, and our son's in New Zealand. And then our youngest daughter's in a biomed program in California. They all want really meaningful careers. Now, here's my question for you. How do you manage? Because I'm watching them bump up, and not just them, but I'm watching young women that age bumping up against a thing that I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but there's a sense that some of the men their age, I'm not talking about my daughters specifically, just young women that age, are intimidated.
The men are intimidated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you're so driven, you're so, what can you tell me about? Because you've had hundreds of conversations about this, thought endlessly about it. Like, what can you tell me about that?
Well, gosh, again, I thought by the time your daughters would be their age that things would have changed. This was definitely prevalent when I was writing my book, and my generation, I'm kind of Gen X, Gen Y, I'm right on the cusp. Everyone told me, like, wait for Gen Z. They're going to change the equation. They're going to be so cool and down with things, and the men aren't going to have such egos around money. And yet, so this is interesting that these women are experiencing this still on the dating field. I mean, Stone Age, man. It's a hard thing to reckon with. It's the primitiveness. It's like I mean, look, Pew Research did a study, and they do this periodically, but their most recent study of Americans and their views on men and women and roles and responsibilities within a marriage and a household. Majority of Americans, men and women, I think 70%, believe that it is more man's quote unquote responsibility role to be the breadwinner, to make the money. So, I mean, that's everybody. That's women and men, right? Essentially. And so what we say, but how we actually feel and how our feelings manifest as actions, different. I think if we were all to take a survey, we'd put our most open-minded answers on the page. But when you're in the context of an actual date, an actual relationship, because I've heard, like, to use the words of the men that, I mean, I had a boyfriend in grad school. I went to Columbia J School, journalism school. And it was spring semester, and I had a boyfriend, and I thought he was, like, super feminist. He was, you know, raised on the Pacific Northwest. Like, he didn't wear shoes until he was like six. He never had a TV in his house. Right. He loved his mother. He loved his sister. They were both strong women. And second semester of that program, I got the opportunity of a lifetime. I got an unpaid internship at CNN. And, like, that's supposed to be a joke. Like, it was, it was great. I got to be at CNN, but, you know, not doing very, very, like running coffee for the anchors and, you know, finding typos and scripts.
But that does feel like an opportunity of a lifetime back then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought I was on my way to being the next CNN anchor. And I told him about it, and we were face to face about it. And the look he gave me, he said, "Wow, what am I gonna do?" Mm-hmm. And I said, suddenly for the first time, I felt like, "Oh, this is a competition? I thought we were friends here, you know." And needless to say, we no longer dated after that. But that would replay on the dating scene when I would go out with, you know, and especially in New York City. I think everybody in these big cities, like, we're all men, women, we're all ambitious. We're all here to, like, make something of our careers for the most part, you know. And in New York, you know, the industries are very high strung. We got finance, you've got media, you've got, like, a lot of people that are just head down working. And so you go out on a date, and I did, you know, stereotypically, you know, the finance bros, you know, they don't want to date a woman who's like, "I own my apartment." And because what they're thinking is, the way that they're interpreting is, will she need me? am I worthy of her? And, you know, there's also these terms we throw around, like marrying up as women. You know, we want to marry up. Gosh, it's so hardwired. And so I guess I'm not surprised that this is perpetuated still now in with Gen Z and younger women and younger men.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I should make it clear that I see tons of progress. Like the conversations, and we spend a lot of time with kids that age, 20, 25, 27 in that age in our home and in our community. And I see a lot of like openness and encouragement. And then behind the scenes, you know, it means navigating some new stuff, right? Like that statement, like, will she need me?
Yeah.
Or what your boyfriend said, like, what am I going to do? Like, if we just have a little empathy for that piece of it.
I totally agree. And I want to say one other thing. And I have a brother and he's successful, but we're different in age. We're very different in age. He's 10, 11 years younger than I am. I grew up with a lot of messaging around as a young girl. There was a very proactive emphasis from teachers, from my parents, television, like, girls of your generation, go out there, go to college, go to grad school. You can have it all, like do it all. And so I felt like I had a lot of wind behind, like I had tailwind in terms of like just this immense amount of support and encouragement and expectation to go out there and make something of myself, because it was part of the feminist movement. You know, our mothers fought for the rights that then their daughters could have. And so they wanted to make sure that we followed through with it, that we took advantage of these new rights. And I think that for boys, it was like expected that they're just going to be able to go do all these things and they wouldn't need as much of like the coaxing and the encouragement and the mentorship. And if you look at the data, like more women going to college than men. And I think that maybe a part of that, again, my very unscientific study of this, because like I'm just using like my worldview, I just don't see the boys getting as much of the sort of the direct advice about how to like go out there make something of themselves, because we just like, because the world's sort of designed for them, right? It's not designed for women. And so women, and I'm not saying that that was a wrong thing to give women all this direction and mentorship, but it's like, we forgot about the boys. And that way, there is a little, I feel like, especially in your 20s, maybe it is taking more time for the boys, the younger men, to figure themselves out. Whereas the women, they have been like on a plan. They've had a plan since they were six because it was handed to them and they were told how to do it and they were encouraged to do it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Really interesting. I totally see that. It's just a new paradigm that needs to be navigated and sorted out. One last thing on that subject. You had a boss that told you that your husband is a lucky man.
Oh, yeah.
What? Tell me about that real quickly, but what else do we maybe hear or say that we're just like, that like we're kind of just unaware? It's been said so often for so long that we're just like, do you realize what that's doing?
Yeah. I mean, that comment specifically was a manager at a company I worked for freelance, and I would submit my time cards every week and he would see my rate and, you know, what I was making. And it was a very nice rate. And it was one of the best jobs I ever had. He also knew that I was writing the book at the time, When She Makes More. So it was like not a secret that I made more than I think we were married at the time. And so he would look at it almost like, it was just, first of all, like, please don't comment on my time card. Like, that's not professional. But it's also like to say that, like, you know, your husband's a lucky man, as though I'm not lucky too. Like my husband brings me no luck, value, or no, I have no fortune being married to a man who makes less than me. It's all him. And I've actually heard that from my mom in a way beforehand, you know, in the early days, where she'd be like, well, your husband's going to have an easy life. You're not. Because as a woman who makes all the money or makes a lot of the money, who also wants to have children, like that's too much on your plate. Like, and he's going to have an easy ride. And that should never be allowed. So it wasn't a compliment to either of us. And similarly with my manager, it was not a compliment to my husband. It was not a compliment to me. It was a dig. It was a passive aggressive way of saying, this is weird.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, along the way I get a lot of it. I just, you know, I think it's funny now. People will, I remember though, one guy, another guy at work, I was working as a fill-in anchor at CBS and the day rate was not great, but I wanted the experience. And I had, at that point I was in between jobs and I had savings. So I was willing to take this like 3-month opportunity to not make a lot of money, but it would be a huge stepping stone in my career. And so at the time I was living with my husband in a, on the Upper West Side, we were renting. And I'll even tell you the rent. It was like $2,800 a month for this one bedroom. It was, you know, in the recession, so it was marked down a lot. But in the penthouse, there was a celebrity. And I just said, we were having a conversation in the office one day about, I was like, yeah, you know, this guy, this celebrity lives in our building. And this coworker of mine started to assume so much from that comment. Right. First, because he said, what does your husband do for a living? Because there's no way that I could have afforded that.
Right.
Right. Because he probably knew my day rate at that time in that job. But, you know, he just like, he just assumed that I was being, that my husband was the breadwinner. Yeah. And so there's that. And then there's also like, you know, you make more than your husband. So who's taking care of the kids? They're just raising themselves.
We believe out here in the West in free range children.
Free range children. Yeah, that's so great.
There's just food out in the backyard. It'll be fine. That's amazing. I've been really curious over the last 5 years, 5 or 10 years, to sort of just learn what assumptions I had that I was just way off and that were painful to other people when I finally heard of them or learned of them. And so it's, I think we're all hopefully continuing to grow and learn from those. Like, yeah, just so super helpful. Let me just wrap up with a couple questions. Farnoosh, how do you think about enough?
I think about it a lot. I think it's this word that has changed a lot for me over the years. When I think of enough, I often think about what it feels to feel wealthy for me, for us, you know, what is enough money, but also when have I had enough of, when I've had enough of the work, of the stress. And
I like that.
When my kids were younger and we were living in Brooklyn and we live in the suburbs now of New Jersey. And when we were in Brooklyn and they were little, we had a full-time caregiver. They were going to, their preschool wasn't free. So we paid for preschool and we paid for, you know, a lot of costs that we just don't have now. And so back then I did work a lot more and I proactively sought out more and more and more work. And because that back then enough, it felt like it was never enough, you know, like to be able to just, and then you get to a point where you're like, what do we have to show for this? We have built all this equity in our apartment. We're not cash poor, but we're very much house rich. Wouldn't it be nice to sort of sell this house and take out some of that, take out the equity and have some options? So we don't feel like we just have to keep working and working and working, that maybe we could even work less and then lower our costs and get some of our time back and get some of our stress down. So we moved to the suburbs and we did that. And now I don't need as much. I don't need the enough of 2024 is not the enough of 2014, not even close. And I love that. I love that. But I feel like I have set myself up for that kind of being able to sort of pull levers, you know, where if I want to make more and I want to have more, I probably could figure it out, but I'm enjoying to have this more of a balance. Enough is where you're making enough for us to afford the necessities, the non-negotiables every month that we have committed to, the mortgage and things of that nature, property taxes, and then, you know, basically figuring out what is the lifestyle that you aspire to have. What does that look like on a yearly basis? What are the luxuries that you want to afford? What are the things you're willing to cut back on? What's not important to you? these are ongoing conversations. It's not like you decide this at 25 and then you just, you know, it's plug and play. It is you. I think people, I want to give people the permission to always be moving that goalpost. And in some years, maybe enough, you know, it's 2x because there's more on my plate that I want to address. But I hope that it always feels like a choice for people. That's that to me feels like financial freedom when you can choose you're enough, given wherever you are in your life and how hard you're willing to work and not work, or not even hard work, but like the way that you work.
I love that. Let's assume 20 years from now, still doing the show, the 7-year-old free range child. Now we're joking about the free range thing, but the 7-year-old's on, so they are 27. What do you hope that if I ask them about what money meant, boy or girl, sorry?
My daughter, she's the 7-year-old.
Okay, your daughter. So let's say that your daughter's on, she's 27, and I ask her, like, what does money mean to you? What do you hope she would say?
I hope that she remembers, because I modeled it for her, that it means affording your own choices. Being able to figure things out, being able to get yourself out of a hard situation or create a new opportunity for yourself, ultimately just having agency with a capital A. You know, that's it. I that's what I figured out as I was growing up. I learned it in a hard way. But the lesson was still gold. And I want my kids to have hopefully learned that, but maybe I could have, I hope, modeling that for them in a calmer way, in a less, not as noisy way.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Farnoosh, thanks.
Thank you so much, Carl. These are amazing questions. I love your podcast.
Yeah, so fun. Cheers. I left this conversation with Farnoosh thinking about so many things, but top of my mind was this curiosity I have about how often gender and money, the tension, the traditions, the social structures that we still need to be talking about. This came up in the episode of 50 Fires with my wife. It came up in the episode of 50 Fires with my daughter. There's so much here to unpack. So one thing that I'm finding really valuable, and maybe I can just suggest, find somebody different than you and ask them about their experience with money. Put your own aside for a minute and see what you learn. Notice what you feel. There's still this tension around how other people experience money. As a power struggle, as a source of oppression or power or influence or creativity, like all of this stuff, there's so much tension still loaded into this thing we call money. And I believe the only way to understand that tension is to stop running from it, stop trying to defend against it, and instead listen to somebody else's story. Ask them what it felt like growing up in their family. What does it feel like today? And listen, because I know what happens to me. I learn something, and as a result, I'm changed because of it. So I'm grateful to Farnoosh for taking me on that journey. If you want to learn more about Farnoosh and her work, her podcast is So Money, and the best place to find her, I think, all things Farnoosh, is farnoosh.tv. Cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start a million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Binel Audio, nor Magnolia.